So tonight I'm going to talk about facing difficult truths. And the reason I'm talking about it, ironically, is because it's April Fool's Day. It's funny, in modern times, we associate the fool, we hear the word fool and we think of synonyms like adult or an idiot. It connotes having limited intellectual capabilities. But that's not the archetypal understanding. And it's funny, we even have this verb to fool people, or to make a fool out of somebody, you know? And sometimes that can be done in good spirits, but sometimes it can also be done with kind of an edge of putting somebody down, which is a dynamic very much driven by toxic shame. I think it speaks to the testament of toxic shame that that's what we associate with this day, fooling people and putting people down by making fools of them, you know. Very different from the archetype of a fool. The medieval understanding was much closer to the archetype of a fool. And so there are two qualities that I'll talk about with the archetype of the fool. One is speaking difficult truths. It's been a problem from ancient times up until the present day. Whenever you have an autocratic dictator, he tends to surround himself with people who are yes men, people who are going to tell him what he wants to hear. People often learn very quickly when they're with if they're working closely with an autocrat, don't tell this guy anything he doesn't want to hear. But of course, as human experiences has shown in many periods of history, often the input that the ruler needs is input that he doesn't want to hear. You know? And so the way they address this in the medieval court is they had a fool figure, the jester. And of course, part of the jester's job was to provide entertainment, song and dance and this sort of thing. But part of it was to speak difficult truths, to speak the truth that the king didn't want to hear. And it worked because the vassals of the king, they all had their own armies. And so they were potentially threats to the king. And the king knew this. And so any disloyalty among the vassals was punished very, very quickly by the king, you know. And so the vassals learned it's probably better not even to say anything that the king doesn't want to hear. But unlike the vassals, the jester didn't have any armies. The jester was just an entertainer, you know, so it was less threatening for the jester to say the thing that the king didn't want to hear. So that's one aspect of the fool. Another aspect of the fool is innocence. And it's funny, when we think of innocence in modern time, we think of it as close to naivete. You know, innocence is something that you have when you're very young and then you lose it as you gain experience in the world. And I would say that innocence is actually more an archetypal quality. Of course, you know, children do have a lot of innocence. Children have a lot of archetypal qualities, as it turns out. Innocence is a way of being undefended, a way of trusting life. Not trusting that it's going to be the way I want, but trusting the essential goodness of life, trusting, you might say, the teaching, that whatever happens, I'm going to be able to deal with it. Whatever happens, I'm going to be able to learn from it and become a better person because of it. You know, that sort of thing. Innocence was very important in the medieval stories. The knights who found the Grail, either Galahad in some versions, Parzival in other versions, they were innocent, and their innocence is what helped them find the Grail. And innocence is certainly a quality that is very helpful in facing difficult truths. So where do we find difficult truths? How do we get these difficult truths even to face them? You know, one important way is feedback. Now, as some of you know, I was a member of a meditation group called CAFH, C-A-F-H, for 20 years. I joined it in my early 20s, and I left it about 15 years ago. I felt that I had kind of outgrown it. But I learned so much from CAFH, and I'm so grateful to CAFH. And one of the big CAFH ideas is, if I'm really a spiritual person, I have to be very curious about how the way I move through the world lands in the lives of others. You know, in other words, if I'm sitting in meditation and I'm having a great experience seeing the face of the Buddha and all that, but I'm walking around in life and people think I'm a jerk, then I'm not a spiritual person, you know? Like, I really have to be curious. Am I having good effects on people as I move through the world? And one of the things that CAFH emphasized over and over again is, I have to be open to feedback. As a spiritual person, that's part of my job, to be open to the feedback of others. You know? And feedback is funny, because if it's feedback from a stranger or feedback from, say, you know, a mere acquaintance, there's no guarantee that that feedback is going to be 100% gold for me. You know, many times people's feedback says more about them than about me. But even that's an important exercise. That's an important boundary exercise, you know, to discern, all right, you know, this person who doesn't know me well just gave me feedback. Maybe 95% of it doesn't have to do with me, but 5% does, you know, and can I really sort out the stuff that doesn't apply to me from the stuff that does, you know? That is an incredibly valuable boundary exercise. But of course, the rich feedback comes from the people who know us deeply, comes from dear friends and lovers, you know? And we can say to these people, you know, be honest with me, you know, feel free to challenge me. You know, I can say that, but then when I'm challenged, if I freak out, implicitly I'm giving the message, don't challenge me, you know? And so part of how we receive feedback is, can I really receive it in a balanced place? Can I receive difficult truths in a mature, balanced place? And that doesn't mean necessarily denying my emotions, you know. Part, you know, it's always healthy to feel whatever emotions we have and to be honest about that. So a mature way of facing difficult truths would take that into account. I'll give an example. I have a dear friend who, a very wise person, and recently he's been facing a number of thorny issues, and I and a few of his other friends have been urging him to seek a therapist. And he was putting it off for a couple of weeks, and then he finally made some calls, and he was sharing, you know, just in making those calls, just those logistical calls, you know, setting, you know, talking about when we could meet for a first meeting, he said, even then I found all those emotions that I've been trying to push down, they were coming up as I was making those phone calls. And that's probably a good sign that I need to be talking to a therapist, you know. And so it's that vulnerability of acknowledging the human reluctance, you know, there are emotions there that I don't want to feel. And I need to take steps to face that, you know. That I would call a very balanced approach to facing difficult truths. You know, making room for the fact that they are difficult and I have all the emotions around that. And I'm going to do what I can to face him anyway, you know. So what does it mean? How do we get to the place of facing difficult truths well? That has to do with this all-important quality known as capacity. And I've talked a lot about capacity. I'll review it here. I think it was about 10 years ago that a dear friend of mine said to me, the most important question in life is how deep is your capacity? And I've been contemplating that statement for about a decade now, and I'm just astounded how deep and how resonantly true it is. Capacity is about how big an emotional situation, how big an emotional energy can I hold, you know? And so if I encounter an event that is within, that is smaller than my capacity, that is within my capacity, then I can remain connected to my heart. I can remain present. I can remain intentional. If I have chosen ideals, I can live out those chosen ideals. You know, I'm still in the driver's seat of my life, as it were. When I encounter an event that is beyond my capacity, that overwhelms me. Then ego's no longer in the driver's seat. It's like, you know, ego lets control of the wheel, as it were. You know, often a lot of very dysfunctional, infantile patterns come to the surface when we're overwhelmed. Often we need to be taken care of by others when we're overwhelmed. You know, so any possibility of living according to my chosen ideals is completely out the window when we're overwhelmed. And so I'd say there are some people in the world who have very small capacities, and they're just constantly overwhelmed by the ups and downs of everyday life. And they move through the world thinking that life is so hard for them. And of course, they don't even have the capacity to recognize that a lot of their problem is their own capacity, you know. I would say that many mature people have what I'd call a conventional level of capacity. They can handle the ordinary ups and downs of everyday life perfectly fine, but then more exceptional energies overwhelm them. And in my experience, personal growth and spiritual growth really require tremendous capacity. Certainly healing requires tremendous capacity, much, much more so than the conventional person might have. Because when we start to work within, we're facing incredibly powerful forces within us, you know, the dragons, the demons, the monsters within, you know, this kind of thing. Well, the way we grow our capacity is simply by having a habit, ideally a daily habit, of living at our edge. A daily habit of just whatever difficult truth we're working with, just leaning into it as much as we can, facing as much as we can, feeling as much as we can that day. And of course, it's just the nature of the way that the psyche acclimates. If I feel into as much as I can today, then tomorrow I can feel into a little more. And then the next day I can feel into a little more. And then over time, my capacity grows. And ultimately, we are responsible for the size of our capacity, you know. So obviously, having a large capacity makes it easy to face difficult truths. And in some ways, you know, when we're saying a truth is difficult, we're saying that it's at the edge of, we're just beyond my capacity, you know. I mean, a truth that is well within my capacity is not a difficult truth, you know. It might be difficult for somebody else, but it's not difficult for me, that sort of thing. So I want to go back to this question of where do we get difficult truths? Where do we find difficult questions? Where do we challenge ourselves, you know? And it's true that, you know, it's wonderful to have an ethic established with good friends and with a lover, you know. Give me whatever feedback you want, be honest with me, challenge me, you know. And it's very healthy when there's a circle of people sharing that ethos, you know? But of course, the problem is if there's a particular difficult truth that none of us are ready to face, then none of us can challenge each other on it, you know? And the group itself remains unchallenged by that difficult truth, you know? But I'd say another source is deep within. There's an archetypal place within us that knows the truth. There is an archetypal place within us that is single-mindedly interested in our spiritual growth and doesn't give a damn about what ego likes or doesn't like, you know? And it's hard to contact this place. First of all, it takes tremendous discipline of tremendous mental discipline, disciplining the monkey mind, because the monkey mind is going to do whatever it can to prevent us from meeting that place. You know, the monkey mind kind of realizes, you know, the jig is up. If we meet that place, we're not going to listen to anything the monkey mind has to say on the issue anymore, you know. So we need to be able to silence the monkey mind. And we also need to have this tremendous innocence, of just being open to whatever we hear from this place within. I'm going to end with a wonderful poem by David White that is about contacting this archetypal place. So I'm going to read the poem and then talk about it, and then I'll read the poem again. Sometimes, if you move carefully through the forest, breathing like the ones in the old stories who could cross a shimmering bed of leaves without making a sound, you come to a place whose only task is to trouble you with tiny but frightening requests, conceived out of nowhere, but in this place beginning to lead everywhere. Request to stop what you are doing right now and to stop what you are becoming while you do it. Questions that can make or unmake a life. Questions that have patiently waited for you. Questions that have no right to go away. So a few comments about that poem. One is the image at the beginning. It's drawn from Native American traditions. In fact, I think the poet David White actually talked about it when he was a child. He had this book about Native American stories, and he drew this image from it. But the idea that, you know, suppose in a forest there might be a patch of, you know, a large patch of dead leaves on the ground, you know, and any of us walking through the forest, we're going to just traipse through it. It's going to make a tremendous amount of noise, and any animal within 300 yards would hear that we're there in the forest, you know. Now, of course, Native Americans would enter the forest to hunt. And so part of the skill that apparently they learned is even when they were crossing dead leaves, they could walk across that without making a sound, because you wouldn't want to alert the prey that you were close, you know. And David White uses this as an image here, like just as it would be a skill to be able to walk across dead leaves without making a sound. Analogously, it's a skill to quiet the monkey mind. It's a skill to create that silence within. And that's part of what we need to do. We need to create that silence within to get to that place that's going to challenge us. And so then the poem has this wonderful line, request to stop what we're doing right now and to stop what we're becoming as we do it. You know, it's the simple truth of life. And it's a simple truth that's hard to look at, but our life is shaped most deeply by what we do every single day without fail. That's what most deeply shapes our life, you know. And if there are patterns of pain worry or fear or that, you know, et cetera, that we're playing out every single day, day after day after day, our life is being shaped by pain. And the more our life is shaped by pain, the more we're pushing away love and joy, you know. We're often somewhat aware of what we're doing every day. We're often less aware of what we're becoming by the fact that we're doing that every day, you know. And that can be an interesting thought exercise sometime, you know. The things that I do every day, what am I becoming? What kind of person am I becoming by doing this every day, you know? The final line of the poem, he states in this very dramatic way, questions that have no right to go away. I think I would rephrase that in terms of belonging. Questions that we encounter with a deep sense of belonging, you know. And I think the, you know, the egocentric way would say it is those questions really belong to me. But I think it might even be more accurate to say, I belong to those questions, you know. So I will share the quote sheet. The poem is at the bottom of the quote sheet. So again, sometimes if you move carefully through the forest, breathing like the ones in the old stories who could cross a shimmering bed of leaves without a sound, you come to a place whose only task is to trouble you with tiny but frightening requests, conceived out of nowhere, but in this place beginning to lead everywhere. Questions to stop what you are doing right now and to stop what you are becoming by doing it. Questions that can make or unmake a life. Questions that have patiently waited for you. Questions that have no right to go away. So I'll go now to the top of the quote sheet. The first one requires a little explanation. God comes forth in the sign of the arousing. The arousing is one of the Bagua, one of the eight trigrams or eight diagrams that are the basis of the I Ching. It represents thunder. And it has a very unsettling quality to it, you know. And this quote from Confucius, from the Confucian commentaries on the I Ching, God comes forth in the sign of the arousing. It really is saying that often when an important truth enters our life, our first experience of it is one that is deeply unsettling, you know. It rattles us. God comes forth in the sign of the arousing. There's also a quote from the Gospels. In the Gospel of John, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. We'll see a few variants of that in the quotes. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, only to the degree that people are unsettled is there any hope for them. Emily Dickinson said, the truth dazzles gradually or else the world would be blind. Van Gogh said, normality is a paved road. It's comfortable to walk, but no flowers grow. Mythologist Walter Otto said, he who begets something which is alive must dive down into the primeval depths in which the forces of life dwell. And when he rises to the surface, there's a gleam of madness in his eyes, because in those depths, death lives cheek by jowl with life. The primal mystery is itself mad, the matrix of duality and the unity of disunion. T.S. Eliot, in a passage from the Four Quartets, says, "There is, it seems to us, at best, only a limited value in the knowledge derived from experience. The knowledge imposes a pattern and falsifies, for the pattern is new in every moment, and every moment is a new and shocking valuation of all we have been. We are only undeceived of that which deceiving could no longer harm." You know, and that final line is very powerful, you know, that our illusions harm us in some way. And really only when the illusion has run its juice and can no longer harm us, that's when it's no longer a difficult truth. And then we can understand it very easily, you know. Solzhenitsyn said, "We do not err because truth is difficult to see. It is visible at a glance. We err because this is more comfortable." Jack Kerouac said, "The only people for me are the mad ones, the ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time, the ones who never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, burn, burn like fabulous yellow Roman candles, exploding like spiders across the stars, and in the middle you see the blue center light pop, and everyone goes, oh." The playwright Kobe Abe says simply, "You wonder what's inside. You wonder if you can trust it." Flannery O'Connor says quite plainly, "Truth does not change according to our ability to stomach it." James Himmlin said, "Anytime you're going to grow, you're going to lose something. You're losing what you're hanging on to keep safe. You're losing habits that you're comfortable with. You're losing familiarity." Edward Abbey said, "Why this cult of wilderness? Because we like the taste of freedom, because we like the smell of danger." MLK said, "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy." And in a way, what MLK is saying is, the most important question in life is, how big is your capacity? Derrida said, "Monsters cannot be announced. We cannot say, here are our monsters, without immediately turning the monsters into pets." And it's funny because a truly difficult truth first appears to us as a monster. Wendell Berry, the poet, said, "In human culture lies the preservation of wildness." The poet Mary Oliver said, "This is the first, wildest, and wisest thing I know, that the soul exists and that it is built entirely out of attention." The poet Tom Hennen said, "Help me be in the world for no purpose at all except the joy of sunlight and rain. Help me, keep me close to the edge where everything wild begins." David Foster Wallace said, "The truth will set you free, but not until it is finished with you." Tara Brach said, "If our hearts are ready for anything, we are free to be ourselves. There's room for the wildness of our animal selves, for intimacy and understanding, creativity and productivity. There's room for spirit, for the light of awareness to suffuse our moments. The Tibetans describe this confidence to be who we are as the lion's roar." And the funny thing about that quote, we can read the words, you know, but when somebody really is totally embodying their animal energy, their human side, their spiritual side, and they have that complete confidence in all those dimensions in being who they are, their presence is like a lion's roar. Their presence is incredibly powerful. Henry Cloud said, "There is a big difference between hurt and harm. We all hurt sometimes in facing hard truths, but it makes us grow. It can be the source of huge growth. That is not harmful. Harm is when you damage someone. Facing reality is usually not a damaging experience, even though it can hurt." Jerry Joyner said, "The truth will set you free, but before it does, it will make you angry." Alex Delp said, "Love makes the wildest spirit tame and the tamest spirit wild." Nikita Gill says, "Some days I am more wolf than woman, and I'm still learning how to stop apologizing for my wild." Victoria Erickson said, "Half of me is filled with bursting words and half of me is painfully shy. I crave solitude, yet I also crave people. I want to pour life and love into everything and also nurture my self-care and go gently. I want to live within the rush of the primal intuitive decision, yet also wish to sit and contemplate. This is the messiness of life, that we all carry multitudes, and so must sit with the shifts. We are complicated creatures, and ultimately the balance comes from this understanding. Be water, flowing, flexible and soft, subtly powerful and open, wild and serene, able to accept all changes, yet still led by this pull of steady tides. It is enough." Shikoba said, "The wild winds called to her soul, and through the ground she felt the thundering hooves of freedom." Just such a resonant image. Rita Kint said, "Sometimes I think I live in a gap between two worlds. One world where I have to wake up to be an adherent of the rules and live in a place that is dictated by others, a place that I sometimes feel the fear of aging and dying before I have figured out what it is I'm here to do. That other world is sweet, fresh, and misty, inviting adventure into the unknown, melding ancient wisdom with new discovery, the sunlight turning into moonlight, and the spell of eternal life is never broken. Perhaps in that gap, I should repair the forgotten bridge from one side to the other. But truth be told, I don't want to. I don't want to because I don't have the energy to fix what is broken within. I am a wild, wandering nomad. I belong everywhere and nowhere all at the same time. And in that gap between the worlds, I am free." I really like that quote. And it's funny. I'd like to think that by my Dharma talks, I'm trying to build that bridge or repair that bridge. But I totally respect Rita Kint's, her position on this. Adrian N. says, "My wild spirit is my deepest truth, in my greatest experience and my highest love. It cannot be contained. It defies rules and explanations and logic. I embrace my untamed spirit and unleash her into the world that is meant to be filled with love and joy and laughter. I feel the wind in my hair. I lift my gaze to the sky. I raise my arms and invite the thunder. I remember how great it feels to be exposed and wildly alive." And that last sentence is just a wonderful description of innocence.